WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1987, when the Cold War was still on, the granddaughter of a former U.S. president met the head of the Soviet space program. They fell in love, while the CIA and KGB looked on. As the Soviet Union disintegrated, they married. My guest is Susan Eisenhower. She's written a new book called Breaking Free, a memoir of love and revolution. Her grandfather, Dwight Eisenhower, was president in the early years of the Cold War. Susan is an expert on Soviet affairs. She met her husband, Roald Sagdiev, at a conference she helped organize, which brought together policymakers from the U.S. and Soviet Union to engage in public debate. Sagdiev was an advisor to Gorbachev at the time. She met him the first evening at the conference at a barbecue.
The great opening line of the romance, I mean, if you can believe it, is he came up to me at this party and introduced himself and asked me if my grandfather was serious about the military-industrial complex. I was slightly annoyed by the remark because I thought, gee whiz, you know, do we have to be answering this question every time we go out? And I said, I think he was perfectly serious. But then I said, and we can't wait for the day when the Soviet Union will admit that it has a military-industrial complex too. You know, the Soviet Union had traditionally used this notion of the military-industrial complex as propaganda against defense contractors who make profits on, legislation, that sort of thing, that enables them to build these weapons systems, etc. But instead of, you know, going through the whole, you know, American profit-making motive and all this long polemic response, he leaned forward and he said, of course the Soviet Union has a military-industrial complex. He says, I work with those guys, and they shamelessly chase contracts, too. Well, I must say, I was completely floored, because not only was he the first Soviet ever to say anything even remotely like this, but the fact that he announced that he worked within the complex as well really made me very embarrassed and almost unwilling to go further with the conversation.
When did you and Roald Sagdiev realize you were beginning to have feelings for each other?
Well, I think he'd probably tell you that it happened for him earlier than it did for me. I must say, I was quite suspicious of him, to be perfectly honest with you. He had a reputation of being very bright and open, and many people, admired him, though they were wary of him, because he brought glasnost to the civilian space program in the Soviet Union long before Gorbachev came onto the scene. But I myself had been raised in a very cautious way, and I was, you know, deeply suspicious, really, of everything Soviet. While I wanted to see an improvement in our relations, I had no illusions about who the authorities would put before me. So I was pretty cautious about the whole thing.
So you wouldn't allow yourself to feel anything early on?
Oh, I didn't allow myself at all. And in fact, as I began slowly to develop some feelings for him, I really was quite determined to keep the brakes on, to minimize my exposure to him. But he was extremely persistent.
How did you test him to figure out whether he was really using you for political ends or whether he really cared for you?
Well, I'm not sure there was really any way to test him. It's just that over the course of time, he began to talk to me more and more about the condition of his society and the way he saw the future of the regime going. And I was so impressed by his honesty and his openness. He frequently said things that were, I guess, could be regarded as anti-Soviet in nature. Again, of course, I had to be very cautious about that, too, because certainly in the old days, KGB people would be sort of planted to be similarly open. I did actually at one point confront him about his ties to the intelligence community, and he laughed and said, listen, I'm a member of the American Academy of Sciences. You think they didn't do a background check on me? I was a little embarrassed I'd asked him, because by that time I already knew perfectly well that he was a scientist, and international scientists often have their own frame of reference for how they view the world.
When you started to get to know each other, it was in a pretty official capacity. You were both at conferences. But when you wanted to get away and talk a little bit more personally, where could you go without looking suspicious or feeling uncomfortable?
Well, there was virtually no place to go for an extremely long period of time. In fact, we were with what in the old days would have been regarded as a chaperone, I guess, but under these circumstances, it was slightly more sinister. When we were in Moscow, of course, Roald had his chauffeur driver who never left him alone, and he had his assistant who stuck with us like glue. And when he came to the United States, of course, he was always assigned a so-called escort. They were notoriously individuals who worked for the intelligence community who were there to make sure that a person like Sagdeyev wouldn't defect while he was in the United States or on some foreign trip. So, I mean, we were around people constantly. And, of course, this was one of the big challenges because as I wanted to know more and more about who he was as a person, it was very hard to find time and place to be alone or indeed out of earshot. I mean that quite literally because many of the rooms, probably most of them, that we were in the Soviet Union were bugged anyway.
Did you have any evidence that you were under surveillance by the KGB or the CIA?
Well, you know, evidence, it's hard to say. I'm convinced that we were. I had terrible problems with my telephone at the office and also my home phone.
You think that was the CIA or the KGB?
Well, I'm not sure how it works technically. In fact, some people will say that it's impossible for the KGB to tap phones within the United States. Without really addressing myself to that question, because I'm afraid I don't know the technical details, I can only say that after I would be back from a trip for a certain period of time, like after I'd been back for a month or so, all of the interference and this slightly high-pitched beep would go away. And certainly, as our relationship developed, there was no question that we were under surveillance by the KGB. Years later, I had this well confirmed by a person who reported to those authorities. But we were aware of it, and of course, it created a tremendous pressure, really.
Something that I'm sure must have added even more pressure to your situation was that you are the granddaughter of the late Dwight Eisenhower, a former president of the United States. So your behavior, especially in the political arena during the Cold War, had to be above and beyond reproach.
Well, that's true. And the thing is that, you know, I loved my grandparents deeply, and I took all this very seriously. I mean, I feel like I'm a steward of the Eisenhower name, and this was on my mind a lot as this relationship developed. I guess, though, over the course of time, everybody has to live his or her own life. And this is part of what this book is about, is really coming to terms with my own rights to have a life of my own and actually for him to do the same.
My guest is Susan Eisenhower. She's written a book called Breaking Free, a memoir of love and revolution. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Susan Eisenhower. She's written a memoir about how she, the granddaughter of an American president, fell in love with and married the head of the Soviet space program. You were advised at one point to keep the relationship as open as possible. Who gave you that advice and why did they give it to you?
Well, a very dear friend of mine who is now a federal judge, as a matter of fact, a man named Paul Michel, warned me. He was the only person I'd confided in, but we'd been such old friends that I thought, you know, he would certainly keep my confidence. And he had been on the Senate Intelligence Committee many years before, and while no longer had ties to the intelligence community, would certainly know what we were up against, and that is Roald and I. And he absolutely advised. First of all, he thought it was crazy to be in love with somebody like this in the first place. But he warned me very, very strongly to keep everything as open as possible because he said that if we were seen sneaking off or going places, that the KGB could well assume that he was passing secrets to me. You see, I wouldn't have had any secrets to convey to Sagdeyev, but certainly Sagdeyev knew plenty. And that they might, if they didn't actually have proof of it, the implication, of course, was that they could set me up as a way to, you know, discredit me or evict me from the country or make sure I never came back. And actually, I think Paul Michel's advice was very sound. Because
did you follow it?
Yes. I would say In very large measure. I mean, there were certainly times towards the end where we decided to hell with it, we're not going to live like this anymore. But that was really partially, you know, a decision that sprang out of the fact that by playing this game with the regime, you actually let them win. And that was a very big turning point for me because there were huge personal risks. I mean, risks to people's reputations, to my husband's safety, or the man who had become my husband's safety. But at a certain point, you know, it's very, very difficult to continue playing other people's games. And so there was a moment when Roald and I decided that we weren't going to play this game anymore, and if the Soviet authorities were going to do something to us, then they'd have to do it to us. But we weren't going to pass up the rare moments we had together to be, you know, continuing to orchestrate our relationship on such a peculiar and unnatural footing.
What was your family's reaction?
Well, my family, I thought, reacted very well. I was very proud of them and very touched. All of them supported the wedding. My father actually came to the wedding in Moscow, and they really took an immediate liking to Roald and understood what it was I was doing. My father is a remarkable person. I think he understood, you know, many years before that his siblings had their own lives, and it was important that he support them while they live them. And so I was very lucky in that because he never once raised the notion that this might be a political or a social scandal of any kind.
Let me change the subject a little bit. How did you find out that your grandfather was president? Did someone in your family tell you? Did you see him on TV and go, wait a minute?
Well, I think the first clue here was that we had Secret Service men from
right.
the time.
That's a good clue.
That's right. And I was about 18 months old when he was elected, so I literally grew up with him. But, you know, in a very strange way, you are a product of your own surroundings. And I wouldn't say that I assumed everybody else had big, tall men who followed them out onto the playgrounds at school, but it seemed very natural to me. The thing is, though, is that one got older and older, one realized how much of an oddity this really was. You do have to admit that there is some glorious irony in this whole story of being followed around as a child by the Secret Service men and then followed around as an adult by the KGB.
Absolutely.
It's occurred to me more than once, but I must say that it was great preparation because as a child, in a very strange way, I had some notion that people were really watching me, and I don't mean that in a sinister way. It's just that one understood that being well-behaved was an important part of getting along with your parents anyway and getting along with the Secret Service men, etc. But I did grow up feeling like I lived in a fishbowl, so when it came time to organizing my behavior with respect to the KGB, I found out I was pretty adept at it.
This year is the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II. VE Day ceremonies have already taken place, and in August it's the end of the war with Japan. These occasions must have special significance for you. Your grandfather was so important in the American military, you know, in leading the war, and America and Russia were allies during World War II.
Well, that's right. They were allies. Unfortunately, the alliance didn't last for very long because Stalin had bred into every bit of his personality a deep sense of suspicion. In fact, there was a great deal of hope in the Soviet Union after World War II that Stalin would relax his grasp on the country. But in fact, the exposure to the Western world threatened Stalin deeply. So, in fact, the iron hand of the dictator was felt even more strongly after World War II. Actually, the whole period is really a very sad period, the business of the Cold War. But I think that my grandfather, anyway, not only his wartime legacy was important to me, but I, you know, in reading some of his work now, I understand how much he understood the nature of the Soviet regime. And I think one thing that made it psychologically possible for me to marry Roald is that there's no question in my own mind that my grandfather had a very understood the clear distinction between the Soviet regime and the people themselves. Now, while Roald obviously was part of that regime in some respects, he had his own independent viewpoint, and I think one that my grandfather would have appreciated a great deal.
Do you and your husband have a lot of political disagreements?
Practically none. I mean, it's really scary. No, in fact, I often joke about the fact that at the time of our marriage, he was a Soviet and I was American, and he was a Muslim and I was christened Episcopalian, and he was a member of the Communist Party and I was a registered Republican. I mean, what a contrast on every front. But I don't know what it is. Maybe it is the scientific culture that he was part of. Maybe there is a kind of internationalism that exists. I don't know, but we agree on virtually everything politically. I'm not sure that he would make a good Republican by some standards today, but we certainly are very much in agreement on most things.
Susan Eisenhower, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, nice to talk to you.
Susan Eisenhower's new memoir is called Breaking Free. This is Fresh Air.